You're listening to the Teaching Podcast for Crossridge Women. The following is audio from our fall 2025 study in the book of Job.
Okay, Job 28. It's a poem. And I'm going to make a confession to you right now. I am not very good at poetry. I historically have been a teacher, and I always avoided teaching poetry. I did not love it. And now I homeschool my kids, and homeschool moms, they love a poetry tea time. You like set the table, make little treats, pour a little tea, and read poems together. We don't do that at my house. We're not poetry lovers. But I recently read that 1/3 of the Bible is poetry. And so I have been trying to learn how to read and understand it better because I really, really care about understanding the Word of God. So we are going to read through this poem and observe it together. And like I said, it's not my strength, so I'm hoping that you'll do most of it. But we're going to walk through a few specific aspects of Hebrew poetry that maybe we're not as familiar with as English poet readers. So here's my sort of shape of the day. We're going to look at imagery, and we're going to look at something called parallelism. We're going to do that together. Then we're going to try and find the emotion or the tone in the passage. And then we're going to do the things we're already good at. We're going to look for repetition and contrast, and we're going to find the structure together, which hopefully is going to allow us to arrive at what does this poem mean. Good? Good. Okay. I said we're going to look at parallelism. Give me a thumbs up if you know what parallelism is. Good. A few people. I love that. Parallelism is the hallmark of Hebrew poetry. When we think about poetry, we think about rhyming. When a Hebrew person thought about poetry, they would think about parallelism. Some people describe it as thought rhyming, but I don't know that fully covers it. But it's kind of how two lines relate to one another. So there's three types of parallelism. There's synonymous parallelism. That means the author says the same things two times in a row. There's synthetic parallelism. One line is going to say something. The next line under that is going to expand on the idea. And then there's antithetical parallelism, which is where one line says something and the second line makes a contrast to it. So my plan is to read you one paragraph at a time, and then we're going to look at what imagery Job brings forward and what parallelism we can find. Okay, you can follow along in your book or you can just listen. I'm going to read verses 1-6. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air. Far away from mankind, they swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. Okay. So when we look at that, what imagery does Job use? What things that we see in the world or have experienced is he calling us to think about? Mines. Okay. What about mines? What do we see about mines? Or what do we know about mines? If we know about mines, we know they feel cramped. Going into dark, crampy places where things are hidden. You don't just walk into the mine and grab the gems. You really have to dig. You use a little pickaxe. They can go for it. Okay, good. We also are starting to see some of the imagery that we observed in our groups tonight, right? It's a mine for silver and gold. These are things we know are valuable, iron and copper. Does anybody think they could take a stab at where there's some parallelism in these six verses? So remembering that that's either one line with another line under it that says the same thing, or another line under it that expands on an idea. That's exactly right. So iron and then copper. And even in verse one as well, right? A mine for silver, a place for gold that is refined. So the first idea is we mine the silver, then we refine the gold. Good. Okay. I'm going to read verses 7 and 8. We're looking for imagery and parallelism. That path no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, and the lion has not passed over it. So what image is Job wanting to call to mind for us here?
Yeah.
So the bird of prey doesn't know the path. The falcon that's flying above everyone doesn't see the path. And then, like, the proud beasts haven't trodden it. The lion, the strongest, the most powerful of the creatures, hasn't passed over it. So I think here we're supposed to be feeling how hidden it is, right? That even if a bird flying above can't see it, and even if the most powerful of the beasts can't see it. Do we see any parallelism here? Yeah, exactly. So those are both synthetic parallelism. We have sort of a general statement first and then a more specific one after. And I think the idea is we're supposed to be being drawn further and further into the image about how hard it is to find these things, right? They're not easily seen, not even by the most observant eye. They're not easily trod on, not even by the most powerful beast. Okay. Verses 9 to 11. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks and his eyes see every precious thing. He dams up the streams so they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings out to light. So we have more mining imagery here. I wonder what sort of image this paragraph conjures up for you. Yeah, so we see man is like really, he's going for it in there. He's putting his hand to the rock. He's cutting the roots. He's cutting channels. He's damming streams. He's working hard to do this.
We should feel that effort. And then do we see any parallelism here?
Yeah, he puts his hand to the rock, overturns the mountains. Cuts out the channels and sees a precious thing. Dams up the streams, and then he's bringing the hidden things to light. So it's an unfamiliar way of looking at language. It's not what we're used to, but once you start seeing it, it's going to pop up everywhere. Okay, let's read verses 20 to 22. No, 12 to 19. Here we go. But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for the jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So what imagery do we see here? What picture is Job painting for us?
Sure, so many precious things. And we're supposed to see these things and think about how valuable they are, right? We're supposed to feel that gold and silver and onyx and sapphire and jewels.
Do you see any other imagery here? Maybe like at the beginning. But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. The deep, the sea, sort of a mysterious place.
Yeah.
I was also just thinking of like the idea of something being hidden. We're not seeing it in the land of the living. We're not seeing it in the deep. We're not seeing it in the sea. It's nowhere to be found. Okay, let's look at verses 20 to 22. From where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say we have heard rumor of it with our ears. So what imagery do we have here?
Yeah. It's hidden everywhere.
And what Adele just pointed out there is antithetic parallelism. It's not in the living. It's not with the dead.
But we should be feeling and experiencing at this point in the poem something lost, something that cannot be found. Okay, let's look at the last chunk here. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it, he established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. What imagery is Job using in this last poem to help us understand?
Yeah. We see the wind and the waters and the rain and the lightning and the thunder. And so when we think about weather, can we control that?
No.
No, we can't. And so we see that God is making all these things that are outside of our control, outside of our power.
Okay, so if we think about the poem as a whole, as we read it, what emotions does this poem bring up for us? Or what's the tone?
Because poetry is meant to communicate something intentional to us, but it does it by allowing us to experience that thing in a way that's different than the way prose does that. So it should conjure up a feeling in us as we think about the different images and the different ideas.
We see this like hard work and it's not arriving at anything for sure.
So he takes us on this ride, right? We're feeling hopeless. We're striving after something that we just can't get to. There is a little glimmer of hope there.
Yeah.
What about the feeling of longing? As we hear about all these precious gems and metals and things of great value, I think that Job wants us to feel like we really want this thing. It's really great value to have it, right? So now Stephanie already touched on it a little bit, but there's a really important repetition in this poem. What is the repetition we see here?
So where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? And then, again, it says that. And then there's kind of almost a repetition, but it's a contrast.
It's answering the question. It's saying, there is a place of wisdom. There is a place of understanding. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn from evil, that is understanding. I think it's worth noting that these are the first words of the Lord in the book of Job that are taking place on earth.
Job is recalling something that God has said. But other than this, the only place we've seen God speak is in the throne room. And here in Job, we hear God speak. And he says, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding.
Those kind of three repetitions and contrasts should point us to the structure of the poem. We see the first chunk of the poem. Man is really good at seeking out valuable things in the earth. They fight for and dig out and claw out what is of value. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man doesn't even understand what it's worth. And if he did, he couldn't get it anyways. Where is the place of wisdom? And where is understanding? And then God knows its place. When he made the world, he also formed wisdom. And he says to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. I think the point of the whole poem is to get us to understanding what a big deal it is that God tells us how to find wisdom. And so the question I believe we should be left with is, how do I get wisdom, this exceedingly valuable thing? How do I gain understanding? What is it to fear the Lord and to turn from evil? And the Bible has a lot to say about the fear of the Lord, more than I'm going to touch on in the next 15 minutes. But I want to take you a few places where I think we see what it is and what it isn't. And so John Piper once said, fearing God means that God is in your mind and heart so powerful and so holy and so awesome that you would not dare run away from him, but run to him.
And so where we see every theme in the Bible start and begin its development is in the book of Genesis in the garden. And I'm going to take you to Genesis 3. And here God has created a beautiful and a wonderful world. Proverbs 3:19 tells us that the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. This creation was an overflow of God's character. He brought order from chaos in the material world and in the moral world. We saw that in our poem in Job, right? God made the wind and the weather, and he also made wisdom at this time of creation. And so God creates people to live in relationship with him in this garden, in this world that is his. And he gives them limits. He tells them how to live wisely in his world. Be fruitful, multiply, eat from the trees, but don't eat from those trees. And he invites them to enjoy his goodness and live amidst his greatness. But we know the story. In Genesis 3, the snake comes to the woman and he tells her that the tree is good for food and it's going to make her wise. And she decides to eat the fruit. She rejects God's wisdom. She doesn't fear the Lord. She disobeys him. And then she realizes she's naked and she hides. Here, she fears the Lord in a distorted way. Instead of going to the God that she's walked with, she runs away from him and hides. If we jump ahead to Exodus 20, we see a different example of fear of the Lord. Here, God has rescued the Israelites from slavery by these amazing, awesome miracles. They've seen his power. He's destroyed the Egyptians. He's brought them through the Red Sea. And now they're standing at Mount Sinai and they've received the Ten Commandments. God again has given them instructions for how to live wisely in the world he's created. And God has shown up in smoke and fire and an earthquake and thunder. And in verses 18 and 19, it says this. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die." Their intuition isn't wrong. God is that powerful. He is that great. He is that strong. He does hold their lives in his hands. But they want to stay far off. And Moses says this to them, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." Moses wants them to fear the Lord. He wants them to tremble and be in awe of this powerful God so that they're motivated to stay near, to know him, to obey him, to walk in the way that he's told them to. Moses doesn't want them to be afraid and hide. He wants them to be afraid and walk with God. And then it says, the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. He enters in. We know that Moses doesn't get it right for all of his life. He leads the people and he, at times, does not obey the Lord. But we see here that his fear of the Lord is drawing him into obedience. That tension continues through the whole Old Testament. Some people get it right. They walk with the Lord. They obey because they fear him rightly. Other people fail to fear the Lord and disobey or reject him entirely. But then comes our one example of the perfect fear of the Lord, the one who rejects evil entirely, and that's Jesus. God comes near to his people and demonstrates for us perfect wisdom. In Luke 11:42, Jesus calls himself the wisdom of God. And last year in Colossians, we learned that Jesus is in fact the fullness of God's wisdom demonstrated for us. He shows us exactly what it means to live rightly in the world that God created. And in Jesus, we see the wisdom of God play out in the most incomprehensible of ways. Jesus, who committed no sin and definitely didn't deserve it, suffers like no one before him or after him ever has. He takes on the sin of the world and dies a death he didn't deserve. But in his death and resurrection, Jesus provides the way for us to have a rightly ordered relationship with God. To fear the Lord and to turn from evil is to walk with Jesus, to follow the path of God's perfect wisdom embodied and shown to us, to turn from evil because the great price of our sin has been paid. That is the fullness of wisdom. So then we go back to Job. In your groups, you talked about the context of this passage. Last time we were together, Job's friends were rambling on and on about why he was suffering the way he was. And their explanations for his suffering ultimately sputter to an end. They don't have enough wisdom. They don't have enough understanding to explain to Job why what happened to him did. And in the context of human wisdom failing, Job gives us this beautiful poem where he reflects on the fact that God's wisdom goes beyond what he and his friends are capable of. God's understanding goes beyond theirs. Christopher Ashe is a prolific Job commentator, and he says, "The book of Job is about the search of a believing sufferer for wisdom, the longing to understand why this world is the way it is. This poem invites us to be honest seekers after wisdom while recognizing our own limits in understanding." In Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, it says that the Lord says this about himself: "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." It said in verse 28, we hear the voice of the Lord down on earth for the first time. Job is recalling something he knows to be true about God. And God's words, they offer no answers. He does not know any more now than he did at the beginning of the chapter why he is suffering so greatly. God's words don't address his questions, but the reader is drawn to look at God. He is the focus, not the questions or the answers. Studying this passage, all of Job really, but this passage specifically, has been really good and formative for me. This past little season of life for me has been one full of disappointment and frustration. And while I am far from sitting in the ashes scraping my skin with pottery, I have joined Job in asking the Lord questions. Why? Why this? Why not that? Why won't you do this for me? Why did you do that? And studying this passage has formed me and led me to really deep comfort, actually. Not because any situation in my life has changed or anything has gotten easier, but because it turned my eyes back to Jesus. Job 28 reminded me that while I don't have the answers to my questions, Job didn't have the answers to his questions. The Lord, in fact, does. There is a reason for this suffering that Job is experiencing. There is a reason for the circumstances in my life. And even if I don't know them, I can take comfort in the fact that my God, who is wise, who is all-powerful and all-knowing and always present, is working for my ultimate good. And so I'll end just reading you another quote from Christopher Ashe that I thought was really beautiful. He says, "In a saying crucial to the whole book, in verse 28, God directs our attention away from our agonized questions and towards himself. He does not take us by the hand and lead us to the answers. Rather, he beckons us to bow before the Lord himself, who knows the answers but chooses not to tell us. Turn your gaze and your inquiry away from the answer you want to the God you must seek." And so I just call you to that same thing. I know that in this room there are people who are suffering in real ways, and that is the reality of this world that we live in. And turning our eyes to Jesus doesn't make those problems disappear, but it sure does put them in the right perspective. I'm going to pray for us, and then I'm going to encourage you to pray in your groups for each other, for the needs that you have, and also just that your eyes will be on Jesus. Okay. God, thank you for your good word. And thank you that we can trust that where we don't have understanding and we don't have wisdom, you do. Thank you that you've shown us in Jesus what it looks like to be wise. I pray that we would be women who spend our lives on that, who seek after Jesus, who long to be conformed into the image of your Son. God, I pray for the women in this room and the circumstances in their lives that they don't understand and the things that feel hard. I pray that in them, you supernaturally will allow them to trust that you are at work in them, that you are working things for their goods and for your glory. God, would you just cause our hearts to sing with joy for what you've done for us and for the work that you're doing in us. Amen.
Hey, friend, thanks for listening. For more information and to access our resources, visit crossridge.church/WStudy. And as always, thanks for studying along.